Nigeria's history is not just diverse culturally. Actually, many cultures that are prevalent in West Africa today have their roots in Nigeria. One of such influences is Islam, and the distribution port for Islam in the region was Borno, in Nigeria's northeastern corner. You're welcome to another episode of Nigeria's History in Our Time. Today I'm talking about Borno. Presently, that is the name of a state in northeastern Nigeria, which recently has been the epicenter of the Boko Haram insurgency. But it has not always been like that. In fact, Borno has had both beautiful and turbulent experiences. Nevertheless, a prosperous history. Apart from being the name of a state, Borno was a kingdom in the Lake Chad region. That kingdom and its dynasty lasted 1,000 years, farther than any other kingdom or dynasty in human history. Our story started about the 8th century AD. The kingdom of Borno was very large, far larger than what today is Borno State. It sat on Lake Chad, around which its history revolved. The dominant people eventually were the Kanuri people, and to their east, however, were the Bulala, the nemesis of Borno. They always had their hands to the throat of the Kanuri people of Borno throughout their history. The shallow waters of Lake Chad attracted nomadic dwellers of the southern Sahara, who brought their military and political skills and secured a space there against the aboriginals. I see in Nigeria's history the element of foreign domination is present, like Europeans dominated the aboriginal Native Americans. It has also been insinuated that even Yoruba people possibly purged the aboriginal tribes. We'll get there later. In the Borno case, however, the Sioux tribe resisted that domination vehemently. So, as in S-O. After a while, the tribes that met in the region, we were saying that tribes met around Lake Chad, they were nomadic tribes, and then some of them began to settle, and then they began to mix. That mixture created a new race known as the Kanuri. That is the origin of the Kanuri tribe of Nigeria, a mixture of races forming a race, thanks to the Lake Chad. The Lake Chad region had a number of links with the outside world. If you pick up your map of West Africa, you locate Lake Chad in northeastern Nigeria and southwestern Chad. So it had a caravan route. A caravan route was the medium through which goods and services were transmitted in the earlier times. A long string of camels crossing a desert region. And this caravan linked Borno with Tripoli in Libya. So it was a trade route that linked Africa south of the Sahara to the north. Through this route, goods were exchanged, and when economic activities happened, it's not just things that are being sold or bought, ideas are exchanged too. So one of such ideas was Islam. According to the Arabic scholar Idrisi, Borno quickly rose to prominence in the Arab world during that era. Borno became very popular in the Arab world. It is important to note, however, that Islam became firmly established in the 13th century, but notably among the ruling class. Religion became a thing of the ruling class. Indeed, the form of Islam that was practiced in Borno was the Africanized version, in which, for example, a person who committed murder was handed over to the family of the victim, contrary to normal Islamic practice. The influences of Borno spread in all directions. It introduced Islam and the cultural development gained to areas far and near, because Borno controlled the trade route eastward to Darfur, in present-day South Sudan. See how far that is from West Africa to South Sudan, and possibly introduced Islam to that region. That region of South Sudan. It was Borno that introduced Islam to that place because of the trade. We already said inter alia that when you exchange goods, ideas also exchange themselves. The implication is that Borno leaders became wealthy. Yes, I mean, you exert both religion and economic influence, you become wealthy. One of such wealthy and important leaders was Dunama. He reigned roughly during the time of the Crusades, between 1097 and 1150. He was fond of making pilgrimages to Mecca. Of course, he was rich. On each pilgrimage, he was accompanied by many followers, and then he died in the hands of the Egyptians. We're told that the Egyptians were jealous of his growing influence and power in the Middle East. So they drowned him at the Suez, so we're told. But then the interest of the Borno people in going to Cairo for learning and to Mecca for pilgrimage was quite robust. In fact, a hostel was built by the Borno leaders in Cairo for the use of Borno pilgrims and students who were resident in the Egyptian capital. Then the Aboriginal tribe of Esau, as in Esau, as said before, became involved in a bitter, bloody struggle with the Kanuri. The Esau killed four Kanuri kings in succession. The Bulala tribe also began to belliger the Kanuri people about the same time, so it was really a messed up period in Borno's history. Internal squabbling, when you are reaching the end of the large size of an empire, or even the empire itself, the first thing that is noticeable is the internal squabbling among members of the ruling class or the royal family. And this degenerated, in the Borno case, into a full-fledged civil war. In the end, King Umar ibn Idris was utterly unable to defend his kingdom against the Bulala, and so he moved his capital from N'Djamena in the west of Lake Chad to the east of it. But the Sefawa dynasty, or the Sef dynasty, was able to continue its long history as a ruling house in the new capital of Ngazagamu. There appeared in 1580 the greatest name in the history of Borno. Such great names always appear sometimes at the time when it is most needed. So it was King Idris Aloma. That's his name, Idris Aloma. Very popular name even in present narrations. Before he became king, the queen mother, Magira Aicha, had maintained the kingdom. He established an embassy in Tripoli on the advice of the queen mother, and in return from the region, from North Africa, he got a small force of Turkish musketeers with firearms to boost his army. He used his army for aggressive campaigns, of course. I mean, he was a very powerful man. He attacked the Sou tribe and beat them at the Battle of Damascus. He also beat the Tetala tribe, which was described as high-spirited and warlike. Aloma had muskets and firearms, of course, so The battle was quite easy against the spears, long spears of the Tetala tribe. One impossible total victory was the Kano affair. The Hausa states were not organized into an empire, but they resisted Kanuri conquest and succeeded in driving King Aluma back. The Hausa states were uniquely different. They came together during war, but they never could form an empire. So Aluma fought the Tuaregs and pushed as far as the fringes of North Africa in Ayr and Bilma. After returning home, after a long period of campaign and war, Aluma began to pursue peace and development. He was responsible for building the hostel in Cairo that we spoke about to give comfort to Boronois pilgrims. I said Boronois because that's like you're saying Congolese, to describe Borno people. He replaced the customary practices with Sharia law, so introduced Sharia. He began the construction of buildings using bricks instead of the ones built with grasses. So you see that he was quite a dynamic leader who could borrow ideas effectively from outside his domain. The building of brick houses was mostly not common in his era. So according to Borno Chronicle, Aluma promoted the prosperity of the country and the wealth of the town. In fact, a German scholar and traveler, Henrik Barth, paid tribute to Aluma in the following words. Altogether, Idris Aluma appears to have been an excellent prince, uniting in himself the most opposite qualities, warlike energy combined with mildness and intelligence, courage with circumspection and patience, severity with pious feeling. Barth said so about Aluma. And then Aluma died in about 1617. Misfortune befell Borno after he died, because a string of less capable, not very enterprising kings began to rule Borno. But eventually there was an exception. His name was Ali ibn al-Haj Umar, who reigned between 1645 and 1684. It was described as intelligent and was the only outstanding king of that time. Borno declined, and this decline culminated in the reign of Mey Ahmed. Mey Ahmed reigned between 1793 and 1810. 1810 was roughly a year when the Fulani Empire had already established itself and was even belligerent and threatening to conquer Borno itself or include Borno in its list of empires. But back to Mey Ahmed, he led a campaign against the people of Madana, but his army perished in that war, and that was effectively the end of the military dominance of Borno in the region. And like I said, the Fulani attempted to incorporate it within the Sokoto Caliphate. Although Borno declined politically and militarily, as a center of Islamic culture, it retained its reputation in Africa. And that means that people came from far and near to learn Islam from the Borno Empire. So it was still retained somewhat of a Vatican, not entirely a Vatican or a Sultanate, but a center of learning. In the south of the Sahara, Bono remained possibly the most influential places, most influential towns, or even an empire. And like you said, it introduced Islam to both the East and the West. It was like the distribution portal. So that's it for Borno, a place in northeastern Nigeria. If you pick up your map and you look well, you find its location and how it straddles the Lake Chad region. Very interesting history. My name is Ojoaderemi. Be sure to subscribe and leave a comment. Send suggestions to my email, ojderemi@gmail.com. ojderemi@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.